cried, and she tried to pretend they didn't exist. She'd wanted to have one side only, like a Mobius strip, a Mobius person. But that was a mistake. She was starting to suspect that facing up to the nightmare of the past was what gave you the power to build your future. She was ready to face it, thought perhaps she might even quite like to face it, that there might be not just danger, but joy and love in facing it. And just like that, she'd lost it forever. She should have done what she'd told Quentin to do with Alice, totally correctly, by the way. She should have met it head-on and made her peace with it when she could. Now she'd never have the chance. The books in front of her looked subtly different now. They'd gone from being about the present to being about the past. Or had they? Maybe they had, but maybe that was giving up too easily. Fillory didn't feel dead to her, that was the thing. She could still sense it out there, just the other side of the thin partition that stood between this reality and the next. If she pressed her ear to it, she could still hear Fillory singing to her, however faintly. The wall isn't actually full, you know. She cleared her throat. It was dusty in this damn library. Not necessarily. You could run another row of books under there, along the floor. She pointed. There was still space under the lowermost shelf.
You certainly could not, Penny said.
Well, you actually could, if you wanted to. Fillory, she thought. We're coming. Just hold on a little longer. It was as if, just by convincing Penny, she could keep Fillory alive.
I think you're looking at this too literally, Elliot said.
Maybe you're not looking at it literally enough, Alice said, startling everybody, possibly including herself. Those two walls are empty, and there's space between the windows, too.
It would be very irregular, Penny folded his arms, his gilded hands glowing with indignation. But more to the point, it makes no sense. The map is complete. There is no more Fillory.
That's not completely true, Quentin said. There's a whole bunch of outlying islands. Like Outer Island would be over there, he pointed, if you wrapped it around the corner of the room.
And Benedict Island, I suppose, Elliot said, reluctantly picking up the thread. That's way the hell over there. And who knows what there is on the other side, the west side.
There's a whole other continent, said Quentin.
Plum couldn't tell if they were arguing for the sake of arguing or if she had a real point, but Penny was looking around the room uncertainly, as if the walls were crawling with insects. She even felt a little bad for him.
But not so bad that she shut up. Never let it be said that Plum was without a plan. She wouldn't let Fillory be dead. It wasn't getting off that easily. No more hiding. The two halves of her life would become one.
You could do the night sky, she said. The stars! You could have a bunch of navy books with silver dots on them. You could do that thing where you hang them from the ceiling.
She favored Penny with her most winning beam.
You love that thing.
Penny was not a man much used to being beamed at. It had an effect.
It's not complete, he said half to himself. It's not nearly complete. We're going to need more books, a lot more. Quentin, you have to save Fillory.
That's what I keep saying, Quentin said, and I think I've figured out how. I think I finally know how to fix everything.
Chapter 29
Historically speaking, Alice said, when people have said that, they've almost always been wrong. Quentin loved having Alice alive again. It was absolutely the greatest thing ever. Whether or not she loved him, whether or not she could stand the sight of him, the world, any world, was just so much better with her in it.
What are you going to do? Elliot said.
Something stupid. Penny, where's the Fillory fountain from here?
It had come over him slowly, but he'd been pretty sure for a while now. It was something Alice said. He'd been thinking about Fillory, trying to picture its dying agonies, what it would look like. But, of course, He knew what a dying Fillory would look like. Alice had told them. Alice had seen Fillory's beginning and the end of the world that came before it. The dead ocean, the dead land, the dying god, even if he wasn't completely sure how to do it, he knew what to do. Of course, it was also true what Alice said about people who thought they could fix everything, and it was quite possible that he was about to get himself killed for nothing. But he was going to try, and now was the time. It was 6 Nederlandish blocks from the library to the Fillory Fountain, and they took it at a run. The Nederlandish moon, which was small and strangely squarish, like an old-fashioned TV screen, was low in the sky ahead of them. As he ran, Quentin felt that he was at the heart of a vast cosmic drama, as if the universe had chosen very briefly to turn around just him. Everything was happening at once, but very slowly, as if time were both speeding up and slowing down at the same time. He noticed little details, the outlines of things, the texture of the stones, glimpses of water in canals, shadows in windows. Everything depended on his doing this right. The Fillory Fountain was in the shape of the Titan Atlas struggling under the weight of a globe, which was a bit of poetic license, since Fillory wasn't a globe at all. It was flat. Quentin had planned to hurdle the rim without breaking stride and hoped Fillory's security was completely shot by now. But instead, he pulled up short, because as he got closer to the fountain, he saw that someone was getting out of it. It was Janet, and she had Josh and Poppy right behind her. Janet and Poppy pushed themselves briskly up and over the side as if they just completed Olympic dives. Josh threw an arm and then a leg over and sort of rolled out onto the pavement. Their clothes dried instantly, but their faces stayed shocked and haggard. "It's over," Janet said. "Fillory's dead." The words glanced harmlessly off Quentin's mind. It wouldn't let them in. "Quentin, we just watched it," Josh said. "It was horrible." The others straggled up behind him in the darkness of the square. It was the first time in 7 years that the 5 original physical kids, Elliot, Janet, Josh, Alice, Quentin, were in the same place at the same time, but the mood wasn't celebratory. "What happened?" Elliot said. "What did you see?" Josh and Janet were staring at Alice. Janet grabbed her hand. Josh hugged her. Poppy, in the spirit of the moment, grabbed her other hand, even though they'd never actually met before. "Oh, my God," Janet said. "Oh, my God, Alice." "I know," Alice said gravely, "but just tell us." "Okay, okay." Janet didn't let go of her hand. It was like she needed a lifeline to hang on to. "The sun fell down. Everything started fighting everything else, even the trees. It was terrible. Then Julia came back from the far side and sent us back here." "Shit!" Elliot looked up at the night sky and shouted, "Shit!" The city sent him back a faint echo. "Where's Julia?" Quentin asked. "She must have stayed behind." Janet couldn't meet his eyes. "So that's it?" Plum said. She looked as stricken as the rest of them did. Quentin stepped up to the fountain. If he was going to try, he'd better try. "Quentin, stop," Janet said. "It's dead." "In that case, I'll view the body." "There's nothing there." "The fountain's still here. There has to be something left." "No, there doesn't," Janet said. "And there isn't. Please, Quentin." Even as she said it, the statue of Atlas in the fountain began to move. It bent forward slowly and reached up to the enormous black marble globe it supported on one shoulder. It was preparing, at long last, to set its burden down. "Hey," Quentin said, "not so fucking fast." If Fillory was going to be dead, it was going to have to prove it to him personally, to his face. He side-vaulted over the rim into the water. It should have been cold, but it was hot, and getting hotter. Probably in a few minutes it would start boiling away to nothing. Josh grabbed his arm, but Quentin shook him off. Atlas glared at him, but even though he was twice as tall as Quentin and made of stone, he must have seen something truly murderous in Quentin's face, because he straightened up a little and grudgingly shrugged the globe back into position. Everybody was shouting at him. "Don't be an idiot, Quentin!" Janet yelled. "For once!" "Quentin, don't," Elliot said. "You don't have to." "But I do." Quentin fumbled awkwardly in his coat pocket for the button while trying to tread water at the same time. Somebody had his arm again, and he tried to jerk away, but at the same moment his finger touched the button, and the bottom dropped out. Once again he was free-falling down toward the magic land of Fillory. He never thought he'd see it again. It made him feel almost painfully tender. After all this, everything that had happened, Fillory was taking him back. The whole country was spread out below him, and he was inbound like a deorbiting space capsule. He definitely never thought he'd see it like this. Far to the west, he caught a smeary glimpse of a crash-landed sun like an egg yolk on a skillet, melting and burning in a steaming, boiling sea at the edge of the world. He had a close, booming flyby with a massive object, which he only realized after it was gone was the moon itself, spinning low and off its axis. Fires blazed and dark armies surged across the surface of the world. Something colossal was slowly surmounting Fillory's rim, peering up over it with its enormous, curious face. One of the great turtles that formed the foundation of the world, coming up at last to have a look at what it had been carrying on its back all these thousands of years. Fillory, his beautiful Fillory, was ruined and dying. But it wasn't dead, not quite, not until there was nothing left. Then he was down. The ground shook under his feet, and the air was full of rumbling and tearing and distant cries and the smell of smoke. Burning ash from somewhere whipped by on a hot wind. His arm. Someone still had hold of it. It was Alice. "What are you doing?" he shouted over the noise. "Being an idiot," she said. She actually managed a slight smile, her first of the new era. He smiled too. "Come on, then. We have to find Ember." The button had set them down outside the city gates of Whitespire. The wall around the city was half-collapsed, and one half of the great gate hung askew. Some of the towers of the castle still stood, for now, but they were swaying. Quentin pointed to them. Alice nodded. There was no way they'd find Ember in all this unless he at least halfway wanted to be found, and if he wanted to be found at all, that's where he'd be. "I'll do shields, you do speed," Alice shouted. They spent an intense minute casting on themselves and each other. Then they held hands and ran through the gate together. The streets were deserted. The town looked like it had been bombed, and the inhabitants were either dead or gone or huddled in their cellars. Quentin and Alice ran carelessly, bounding along with exaggerated magical strength. Sometimes they cut through ruins and leveled lots to save time. Once a tremor sent a teetering wall of stone flopping down heavily right onto them, which would have killed them if Alice's spell work hadn't been top-notch. Instead, it just slammed them face down into the dust, and they shrugged off the heavy blocks and picked themselves up and caught their breath and ran on. They didn't slow to a walk until they were passing under the portcullis, and through the thick outer wall of Castle Whitespire. It was the first time he and Alice had been there together. They stepped out into the courtyard. It had been the longest of long shots, a dot in the shark, Elliot would have said, that Ember would be there waiting for them. And he wasn't. But Umber was. Quentin had never seen him before, and until a week ago he thought Umber was dead. But it couldn't have been anybody else. He stood quite still, like a tame ram in a meadow, his head down as he cropped a stray weed pushing up between two paving stones in the twilight of the dying world.
He straightened up.
"I've been waiting for you," he said between chews, "for ages. I made a bet with myself that you'd come, and now look, I've won."
Quentin hadn't planned for this, but he supposed one was as good as the other for his purposes. But Umber seemed to know what Quentin was thinking.
"Well, come on. It's no good with just me. You're going to need us both."
Umber tossed his horned head at them, "Come hither." Under any other circumstances, Quentin would have hesitated, but on this day of all days, his meaning was unmistakable. Quentin jogged over to him, and as he'd imagined doing 10,000 times before at least, he threw an arm and a leg over Umber's broad, soft back and heaved himself up onto it. Alice climbed on behind him and put her arms around his waist. The instant Quentin had his fingers wound into Umber's cloudy gray wool, the god surged forward under them, and they were off. Quentin had always wanted to do this. They all had, and now he knew why. After a few trotting steps to get up to speed, Umber bunched all four legs together under himself and leapt the castle wall like the cow jumping over the moon. The rush and acceleration were beyond anything. He picked up speed as he bounded through the crumbled city and out of it, touching the ground ever more lightly and at wider intervals, trees and fields and hills and walls and rivers whipping past. There was a strange, fateful joy to it. The scene was catastrophic. His mission could not have been more dire, but Quentin Coldwater had come back to Fillory with Alice, and together they were riding a god.
"Hi-ho,"
Umber said, and Quentin answered him,
"Hi-ho."
He still remembered the childish love he'd felt for the two rams back before he'd known Fillory was real. It hadn't lasted. He'd met Ember in person, and he wasn't anything like as strong or as kind or as wise as Plover had made him out to be. Then when Ember had thrown Quentin out of Fillory, his disillusionment had tipped over into anger. But since then he'd learned a few things about acceptance, and his anger had cooled, even if the love hadn't quite returned. Now he saw the rams as they were. Strange, inhuman, somewhat ridiculous beings, as limited by their godhead as they were empowered by it. But they were divine, and there was a majesty to them that was undeniable. Quentin let himself enjoy it. Even as Quentin felt Umber's strength beneath him, Fillory was losing the last of its own strength. Its glorious greenery was withering away before their eyes. They passed men and animals bunched together in shivering packs, no longer even fighting, like the remnants of a party that had got out of control and been shut down and broken up by the police, leaving the celebrants suddenly sober and chagrined. Acres of trees lay knocked down and uprooted. Overhead the stars were beginning to fall, one by one, some in rapid arcs like meteors, others more slowly and gracefully, twirling and sparking and pinwheeling down. Alice hugged him tight. A series of deep, booming cracks sounded, like distant artillery fire, signaling that the land itself had begun to disintegrate. It was losing cohesion, losing even the strength to hold on to itself. Great crevasses opened in Fillory's surface and widened into canyons, and in the depths of the deepest of them, Quentin could see all the way down to the pale, struggling dead of the underworld, writhing in a mass like larvae inside a rotten log. Now Umber's great gallop found them hurdling enormous gaps in the land, which grew wider and wider until in places nothing connected the component shards of Fillory at all, and Quentin began to see stars between them. They were leaping from island to island in the dark of space, flying as much as jumping, soaring through the void. He saw where they were heading. A single fragment of land lay dead ahead of them, an uprooted divot of enchanted turf
with just a field and a pond and a tree, orphaned in the disaster, no longer linked to anything at all. On it, alone, stood Ember. Umber touched down lightly and trotted away his excess speed. Quentin and Alice slid off. Quentin was just thankful that Alice was with him. She believed in him, or she once had anyway. That would make it easier to believe in himself during what was coming next. Ember stood staring down at the pond, a round pool bristling with bulrushes around its edge, eyes locked with his reflection. His face was unreadable as ever, but there was something lonely about him, something despairing and abandoned, as his world came apart around him. For the first time, Quentin felt a little sorry for the old ram. "Ember," he said. No answer. "Ember, you know what you have to do. I think you've always known, since the beginning." Quentin knew. He hadn't put it all together till those last moments in the library, but it had been coming to him slowly for much longer than that. He'd been thinking about parents and children and power and death. After his father died, Quentin had gained a new kind of strength, and Mayakovsky, with his own kind of sacrifice, had given him a new strength, too. That's what parents did for their children. Then Alice told him the story of how Fillory began. It began with death, the death of a god. It was the oldest story there was, the deepest of all the deeper magics. Fillory didn't have to die. It could be renewed and live again, but there was a price, and the price was holy blood. It was the same in all mythologies. For a dying land to be reborn, its god must die for it. There was power in that divine paradox, the death of an immortal, enough power to restart the stopped heart of a world. "It's time, Ember. The bird isn't coming. The spell is gone. This is the only way left." The old ram blinked. He could hear Quentin. "I'm not pretending it's easy, but you'll die anyway when Fillory dies. You know this. There must be only a few minutes left. Give your own life now, before it's too late, while it still matters." The truly sad thing was that Ember actually wanted to do it. Quentin saw that, too. He had come here intending to drown himself, the way the god before him had, but he couldn't quite manage it. He was brave enough to want to, but not brave enough to do it. He was trying to find the courage, longing for the courage to come to him, but it wouldn't. And while he waited for it, ashamed and alone and terrified, the whole cosmos was coming crashing down around him. Quentin wondered if he would have been brave enough. He would never know. But if Ember couldn't sacrifice himself, Quentin would have to do it for him. He took a step forward. He was a man proposing to kill a god. It was an impossibility, a contradiction in terms, but if it meant saving Fillory, then there had to be a way. He held onto that knowledge tightly. If magic was for anything, it was for this. He'd faced up to his dead father and Mayakovsky. He'd faced losing Fillory and losing break bills. He'd even faced Alice. He was circling back to all the things he'd fought and lost over the years, and one by one he was putting them to rest. Now it was time for him to face Ember. He took another step, and now Ember turned on him. The god's eyes were wild, blank with panic. His nostrils flared. Ember was out of his mind with fear. Quentin felt a surge of pity and even of love for the ridiculous old beast, but it didn't change what he had to do. He'd hoped inspiration would come to him, but it didn't. It came to Alice instead. "Your turn this time," she said, and then she did something strange. She bit the back of her left hand, scraping skin off the knuckles, and then touched Quentin's cheek with it. It wasn't a spell Quentin knew, or would ever know. The technicalities were too much for him, and the raw power, too, probably. But he'd seen Alice do it once before. As she chanted the words, his arms burst with masses of muscle, and his skin thickened and toughened at the same time. He felt the special force that belonged to Alice's magic alone transforming him. His legs exploded with strength. He was rising upward on two pillars, and his neck lengthened, and the base of his spine flowed out into a long, sinuous tail. His head was stretching forward into a snout, and his flat, grinding omnivore's teeth grew and sharpened until they interlocked with each other, the way teeth were always meant to do. His nails sprouted into claws. His vertebrae threw up a ridge of spines. It was like his back being scratched, only even better. He was made of power, and there was a furnace in his belly. He opened his mouth and roared a word, and the word was made of fire. He was a dragon, and he was ready. He was going to blast the immortal living shit out of Ember. The fire bent and flowed around Ember's horns, but it scorched him, too. Quentin smelled the burning wool. Maybe as his world crumbled, the god was losing some of his imperviousness. Well, bad luck. Quentin bounded forward and Ember bolted, but it was all slow motion to Quentin's draconian reflexes. He pinned Ember to the ground with one massive taloned forefoot, none of your puny T-Rex arms for this dragon, and tried to get his jaws around Ember's thick, muscled neck while the god writhed frantically in his grip. Quentin's scales, he couldn't help but notice in passing, were the shiny metallic blue of a bitchin' muscle car. He was a dragon, not a god. But he was huge and tough and strong, and this body was made for epic scrapping. Whereas Ember, for whatever divine reason, was a god with the body of an animal that occasionally took part in ritualized male dominance contests, but spent most of its time grazing. Ember rolled and flipped Quentin over him, Quentin lashing his tail crazily, hoping Alice was well clear. Then he was on top again.
"Enough!"
Ember roared, and Quentin was blown back into the air, spreading his wings. His wings! Like an angry angel, Quentin checked his flight and power-dived back at the god, who dodged before Quentin could crush him. They circled for a minute, pacing, the pond spouting steam whenever Quentin's overheated tail touched it. Then he darted forward again and had Ember in his teeth. Lightning struck his back once, and then three, four, five times, jangling his nerves and blowing off half a dozen scales and probably crippling his delicate bat wings. But pain was something a dragon noted only in passing and then dismissed with contempt. Any love or pity he might have felt for Ember was a human thing. There was no room in his dragon heart for any such feelings. This was a job for a monster, and that's what he was now. Die, he thought. Die, you selfish bastard, you miserable coward, you old goat. Die and give us life. Now he had a proper grip, and he held on and ground Ember between his molars like a cheap cigar, and the air bleated out of him. He held on for Alice, for Elliot, for Julia, for Benedict, for his useless, hopeless father, for everyone he'd ever loved or disappointed or betrayed. He held on out of pride and anger and hope and stubbornness, and he felt what was left of Fillory holding on, too, and waiting to see if it would be enough. Quentin blew white-hot fire between his teeth, and his saliva was toxic acid. The ram's ribs bent and groaned, and Quentin felt him try to inflate his lungs, felt him fail. He tasted burned skin, and he felt the skin tear. Quentin held him there, and when the ram had gone 5 minutes without a breath, he spat him out onto the ground. He'd done all a dragon could do. Suddenly Quentin was human again, standing over the steaming, smoking body of the ram, flopped out on the grass like a sleeping dog the size of a bull. But it wasn't over. Ember's foreleg stirred. He was beaten, but some tenacious spark of life was refusing to leave his body. If Fillory was going to live, Quentin would have to tear that spark out of him and quench it. This was what the knife was for, he realized. The one Asmodeus had gotten away with. Shit! Fate had practically shoved it into his damn hands, and he'd fumbled it away. He was in a fight with a god, and he had no weapon. Except that he did have one. Sometimes when you finally figure out what you have to do, you discover that you already have what you need. He'd always had it. Quentin felt around in his pocket, and his fingers found a thick, round coin. Mayakovsky's last coin. This was the last of his inheritance. He felt a twinge of sadness, just a twinge, at the knowledge that he would never make his land now. That would have been nice, but he felt no bitterness. What Quentin did now, he'd already done once, a long time ago, but then he'd done it in anger and confusion. Now he did it calmly, with a full sense of who he was and what he was doing. He still had some nickels in his pockets, the ones he'd brought back from the mirror house. He went to one knee and made a little stack of them on a patch of bare ground, and on top of it he balanced the golden coin, goose side up. Then he gripped the stack in his fist, and it became the hilt of a burning silver sword, which he drew up out of the ground as if it had been embedded there all along, placed there for him centuries ago. He held it up in front of him. The last time he'd held it had been on the day he arrived at Breakbills.
"It's good to see you again," he whispered.
Pale, almost transparent fire played along its length, surprisingly bright in the eerie half-darkness, as if the sword had been dipped in brandy and touched with a match. The fire wasn't really good for anything, but it was a nice detail. He adjusted his grip on the hilt. He tried to remember something, anything, from his fencing lessons with Bingle. Ember's eye half-opened, but he didn't stir. Maybe he couldn't. But if Quentin had had to put a name to what he saw in Ember's eye, it would have been not fear or rage, but relief. Quentin felt it too.
"I'm sorry," he said.
The sword cut almost all the way through Ember's thick neck in one stroke. The wound opened wide instantly, red and wet, the skin snapping back like taut rubber. The god's legs went stiff and sprang apart like a marionette with its strings pulled. Blood sprayed and then pumped from the stump. Quentin felt Alice's hand on his shoulder. It was done. Ember was dead. An age had ended. Quentin had ended it. It didn't feel like an exalted business. There was nothing grand about it. It hadn't felt noble and righteous. It felt rough and ugly and bloody and cruel. It was what was necessary, that was all. Quentin stepped back from the god's corpse. Something big rocketed across the sky, and he looked up in time to spot a fat, stubby spacecraft already dwindling in the distance, an iron fire plug riding an inverted cone of blue flame. The dwarfs, if he had to guess. Always full of surprises. There were only three or four stars left, and even as he watched, one of them lost its grip on the heavens and fell. Behind him a throat was delicately cleared, as if to alert an inattentive waiter.
"Everyone forgets about me," Umber said. "As I said, you'll need to kill us both. We were only ever really one god between the two of us."
He trotted over to Quentin, as meek as you like, sniffed fastidiously at his brother's corpse, and then stretched out his neck. He even waggled his shoulders a little in anticipation, as if the operation were going to give him pleasure. What a perverse creature! Quentin steadied himself and tried to think of all the good that Umber could have done, but hadn't. Maybe the next god would do better. This time the sword stroked cleanly all the way through. The instant Umber died, Quentin exploded. He dropped the sword. He felt himself racing upward and outward. He was blowing out in all directions, his arms and legs stretched out 100 miles, 1,000. His view expanded to take in all of Fillory. He saw it hanging there in space in front of him like a shattered saucer. He was a phantasmal giant, a cosmic blue whale times a billion. He wasn't disconcerted, but only because gods don't disconcert easily. The logic was clear to him, because the logic of everything was clear now. There was nothing that was not self-evident. A god could die, but a god's power did not, and without Ember and Umber to wield it, their power had flowed into the one who sacrificed them. Therefore he, Quentin, was a god now. A living god, the god of Fillory. He was no longer Fillory's reader. He had become its author. But what a broken world had been entrusted to him. He shook his great head disapprovingly. Even now it continued to disintegrate before him, its connective tissue weakening, its edges crumbling. This would never do. It must be mended. Mending was something Quentin understood well, and with the power that was in him now there was nothing broken that he could not fix. With a wave of his left hand he slowed the passage of time to a crawl, so that to everyone but him the work of a millennium would pass in a fraction of a second. Then, slowly, deliberately, and with inexhaustible patience, he began to gather up the pieces from where they hung and drifted in space. He collected the clods and clumps and grains of soil and stone that had been the flesh of Fillory, sorted them like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, and one by one fitted them together and knitted them back into a single whole, running his huge spectral fingertips along the seams until they vanished, as if they had never been. He worked with great care. The dirt of Fillory was marbled like a great side of beef, and he took pains to position its veins of ore so that they lined up just as they once had. He rethreaded Fillory's silver rivers and streams, or where it pleased him he allowed them to find new paths, and he gently shepherded the shattered lakes and seas back into their basins. He swept up the air and the winds and heaped them up in invisible masses above Fillory so that the land could breathe again. As he worked, he rolled and sifted between his divine fingertips the remains of various objects he remembered from his human life, odd little things from long ago, the bones of the gentle bay he rode when he left the centaurs, the fragments of the Watcherwoman's shattered watch, which had been trodden into the earth over the years and dispersed and forgotten. The pistol Janet had brought into Fillory and then dropped on her way out of Ember's tomb. The head of the arrow that killed Benedict. The last rotting remnants of the Muntjac scattered in the shallows of the far eastern ocean. Those animals and humans who had died in the apocalypse he allowed to rest where they were, but he moved among the survivors, healing them, rebuilding damaged organs, repairing and re-sewing skin and bones. He bade the great turtle return to its place in the tower of turtles that held up Fillory and take up its burden again, and it did. It really wasn't suited for a more active lifestyle anyway. He rounded up the escaped dead and returned them to their gymnasium hell, and then, feeling divinely troubled by their plight, he bade them sleep. Peacefully and forever. Their games were over for good. He set the delicate green carpet of grass that covered Fillory to regrowing and restored some of the trees, stepping them like the masts of ships, not all, but enough that they could reseed the forests. He spent a long time, years, maybe centuries, setting the seas to beating at the shore again and nursing the water cycle into some kind of stable, functioning state. He picked up the bodies of Ember and Umber with tender care and buried them where they could decompose and enrich the soil around them. The ground above them became green, and two enormous trees grew over their graves, their branches spiraling curiously like ram's horns. The moon he lovingly polished and set spinning again. One by one he rehung the stars like the crystals of a chandelier. He filled in the great crater that the sun had burned in the ocean floor, and he cooled the sea and rebuilt and remortared the wall that ran around the edge of the world. He took the sun itself in his great cupped hands, pressing and molding it back into a sphere, feeling its fading heat. He blew on it till it burned white hot. Then he placed it back on its eternal track and set it going in its orbit again. He rested. He looked at his work, watched it tick and turn like a great watch, here and there smoothing a rough edge or roughening a smooth one, slowing a torrent or urging on a tide, till all was in balance. When there was nothing else to mend, he simply gazed at it, felt its atoms circulating and combining or simply shivering in place, and he subsided into a grand peace. Fillory lived again. It wasn't what it had been yet, but it would be once it had healed, and that it could do without his help. He could have watched it forever. But it was not for him to do so. He had been given custody of this power, but he sensed that it didn't belong to him. Wistfully, but not regretfully, he restored time to its customary rate of speed with a wave of his right hand. As his last act, a divine whim, really, he retrieved the remains of the white stag from the gullet of the giant snapping turtle of the northern marsh, fused its skeleton back together, reconstituted its organs and its skin, and restored it to life. He placed it on an island far out to sea to begin its wanderings again. The next age of Fillory would have a questing beast, too. Then he allowed the power to leave him. As it did so, he shrank and shrank, the tiny disk of Fillory rising up to meet him and then stretching out endlessly around him, until he stood on it again as just one more of its inhabitants. He wasn't alone. When he was a god, the particular names of Fillory's many inhabitants hadn't greatly concerned him, but now he was in the company of a woman and a demigoddess. And after a few seconds, their names came back to him. They were Alice and Julia. Chapter 30.
"You let go of the power," Julia said. Dawn was breaking over the raw, ragged, still-healing horizon, and he was losing it all already, everything but the faintest, most transparent memory of what it had meant to be a god. He savored the very last of it, the certainty, the power, that sense of total knowledge and well-being and control forever and ever. It evaporated from his mind and was gone. It wasn't the kind of memory that a mortal brain could hang on to. He was just Quentin again, nothing more. But he would always know that it had happened, that he'd known what it was like, both for a few seconds and, in the life of a god, 1,000 years.
"I let it go," he said. "It wasn't mine."
Julia nodded thoughtfully. "You're right. It wasn't yours. A more jealous god, or a more jealous man, might have tried to keep it, though I think the outcome would have been the same. Thank you for doing that, Quentin, for mending Fillory. I might have done it myself, but the fiddly stuff like coastlines always takes me ages. I don't have the knack for it. Also, I thought you might enjoy it."
"Thank you."
"I did. Or I think I did.
Already he wasn't crystal clear on what exactly he'd enjoyed. She was recognizably her old self, still the Julia of Brooklyn, or directly descended from her, with her freckly face and her long black hair. But at the same time she was unmistakably divine. Her height had been somewhat variable in the past, but at the moment she was 7 feet tall. She wore a rather dramatic dress that wouldn't have looked out of place at a presidential inauguration, even though it was made of equal parts bark and green leaves.
"Walk with me," Julia said.
They walked, the three of them together. Fillory was Fillory again, though it was a wan and wasted Fillory, waking again piece by piece after its catastrophic illness. The meadow was still brown, the ground still dry and cracked. The new age was still in its first minutes. Quentin was light-headed. He still had the blood of Ember and Umber on his shoes. It was hard to connect the brutal, bloody thing he'd just done with the renewal of Fillory. But this world was rudely, potently alive again. You could feel it.
"I have a question," Alice said.
"Julia, why didn't you kill Ember yourself? I mean, it all worked out fine in the end, but you would have done a quicker job than we did."
"I might have, but there would have been no power in it. A demigod slaying a god, even if I could have managed it, those are not the terms of the ritual."
"Still, you seem more godly now than you did when I last saw you," Quentin said. "More divine. Am I wrong?"
"You're not wrong. I was made queen of the dryads. I'm a bit more than a demigod now, more of a three-quarters god. There ought to be a word for it."
Now and then Julia would brush a dead plant with her fingers, absent-mindedly, and it would straighten up and become green. When she pointed at a fallen tree, its roots would come to life and grip the ground again, and it would pull itself up hastily, as if it had been caught napping on the job. Quentin couldn't figure out how she decided which ones to revive. Maybe it was random. Maybe some trees were more deserving than others.
"I'd like to do something for you, Quentin," she said, "on behalf of Fillory. You did us a great service today, and you've always served us well. Is there something here that you've never seen or done that you've always wanted to?"
Quentin thought for a minute. He'd picked up the silver sword and was carrying it, but a little awkwardly, since for whatever reason he hadn't managed to summon a sheath to go with it, and he was leery of touching the pale flames that licked along its blade. He stuck it in the ground and left it there. Probably he'd be able to summon it again if he ever needed it. What did he want? It was a lovely gesture, but as far as he knew, he'd been everywhere in Fillory, or everywhere that was worth going. He didn't feel especially interested in the dwarf tunnels, or the Fingerling Islands, or in the tourist attractions of Greater Loria. But wait. There was one thing. "Can you show me the far side of the world? Show us. Alice should come too if she wants."
"Of course."
"It's not like I haven't already been there," Alice said, "as a Niffin." "True," Quentin said. "I forgot. You should get a different reward." "I'll save mine. This is for you. I'll stay here for a while." So Julia took Quentin's hand, and they rose up together and flew west out over the coast of Fillory, faster and faster, across the sea, and then over the wall at the rim of the world and down, head down in a great curving roller coaster swoop. Soon Quentin became aware that his point of view had changed, that without having turned around, they were rising up rather than diving down. Gravity had turned around. They surmounted another wall, and then they were looking out over the far side. Julia paused, hovering. For him it would have been exhausting, but for Julia flying was nothing, and as long as he was with her it was nothing for him, too. Her large hand encased his completely. The feeling reminded Quentin of being a child. It was twilight on the far side. The sun had just set there as it rose on Fillory. He couldn't see much, just hushed fields and valleys. The difference was subtle, but even from this distance it was quieter and more intense than Fillory, richer in whatever made Fillory magical, more densely infused. There was an air of excited expectation. Curious little motes of light sparkled in the dusk, like tiny glowing gnats.
"I can't show you everything," Julia said. "Not even I have those permissions. But there's something in particular I think you might like."
When they moved, the wind moved with them, so that the air around them remained still as they flew. Down below there were dark rivers and pale chalk roads. Quentin spotted what might have been an elaborate treehouse in a forest and a castle on an island in a moonlit lake.
"Are those fireflies?" he asked. "The lights?"
"No, the air is just kind of sparkly here. It's a thing. You don't notice it during the daytime." Tiny lights were bobbing along in their wake, too, streaming out behind them like the phosphorescent trail of a ship in a tropical sea. The sunset was in different colors from a terrestrial or even a Fillorian sunset. It ran more to greens and purples. She set them down in the center of a grand, rambling garden. It must once have been laid out according to a precise design, like a French formal garden, all ruled lines and perfect curves and complex symmetries. But it had been left to go to seed, shrubs overflowing onto paths, vines winding themselves lasciviously through wrought iron, rose beds dying off into withered brown traceries, exquisite in their own way. It reminded him of nothing so much as the frozen community garden he'd wandered into long, long ago in Brooklyn, chasing the paper note that Jane Chatwin had given him before he came out the other side and into Brakebills.
"I thought you'd like it. Of course it was different when it was new, but then when it started to get overrun everyone thought it looked better this way, and they let it go. But it's more than a garden. It's deep magic. Keep your eye on one spot, and you'll see."
Quentin did, and he saw. Slowly, but far faster than they would have in nature, some of the plants were dying and reviving, crisping up before his eyes and bursting back into bloom, rising up and sinking down in slow motion, making tiny crackles and whispers as they did. It made him think of something, but he couldn't quite place it.
Julia could.
"Rupert mentions it in his memoir," she said. "We call it the drowned garden, though I don't know why. The plants aren't just plants. They're thoughts and feelings. A new thought happens and a new plant springs up. A feeling fades away and the plant dies. Some of the more common ones are always in bloom. Fear, anger, happiness, love, envy. They're quite unruly. They grow like weeds. Certain basic mathematical ideas never go away either. But others are quite rare. Complex concepts, extreme or subtle emotions. Awe and wonder are harder to find than they once were. Though, there, I think those irises are a kind of awe. Once in a while, you even see a new one." The peace in the garden was inexpressibly calming. It made Quentin never want to leave, and at the same time he supposed that that feeling was itself manifested in vegetable form somewhere in the garden. He wondered where and whether he'd know it if he saw it. Julia stooped to one knee, an awesome sight given the scale of her divine frame.
"Look, this one is very rare."
Quentin kneeled down, too, and a few of the sparkly motes gathered around them helpfully for illumination. It was a humble little plant, fragile, a fledgling shrub with a few sprays of leaves, a Charlie Brown Christmas tree. As Quentin watched, it wobbled, losing heart, and its leaves browned and spotted, but then it caught itself, filled out again, and stiffened, and even grew an inch. A couple of seed pods sprouted from its branches. He recognized it. It was the plant he'd seen drawn on the page from the Netherlands, and again in Rupert's spell. He'd given up on ever finding it, and now here it was, right in front of him. Julia must have known. All unexpectedly, his eyes were full of hot tears, and he sniffled and wiped them away. It was ridiculous crying over a plant. He hadn't cried when he killed Ember. But it was like seeing a loyal old friend he'd never even met before. He reached down and touched one leaf gently.
"This is a feeling you had, Quentin," she said. "Once, a very long time ago, a rare one. This is how you felt when you were 8 years old, and you opened one of the Fillory books for the first time, and you felt awe and joy and hope and longing all at once. You felt them very strongly, Quentin. You dreamed of Fillory then, with a power and an innocence that not many people ever experience. That's where all this began for you. You wanted the world to be better than it was. Years later, you went to Fillory, and the Fillory you found was a much more difficult, complicated place than you expected. The Fillory you dreamed of as a little boy wasn't real, but in some ways it was better and purer than the real one. That hopeful little boy you once were was a tremendous dreamer. He was clever, too. But if you ever had a special gift, it was that." Quentin nodded. He couldn't quite talk yet. He felt full of love for that little boy he'd once been, innocent and naive, as yet unscuffed and unmarred by everything that was to come. He was such a ridiculous, vulnerable little person, with so many strenuous disappointments and wonders ahead of him. Quentin hadn't thought of him in years. He wasn't that boy anymore. That boy was lost, long ago. He'd become a man instead, one of those crude, weather-beaten, shop-worn things, and he'd almost forgotten he'd ever been anything else. He'd had to forget, to survive growing up. But now he wished he could reassure that child and take care of him. He wished he could tell him that none of it was going to turn out anything like the way he hoped, but that everything was going to be all right anyway. It was hard to explain, but he would see.
"Someone must be feeling it now," Quentin said. "What I felt. That's why it's green."
Julia nodded.
"Someone? Somewhere?"
Though even now the plant shrank and dried and died again. Delicately, Julia pinched off one hard seed pod and straightened up.
"Here, take this with you. I think you should have it."
It looked like a seed pod from any ordinary plant anywhere, brown and stiff and rattly, but it was unmistakably the one from the page. He'd have to find a way to show it to Hamish. He put it in his pocket. The plant didn't seem to mind. It would grow again, sooner or later.
"Thank you, Julia."
Quentin dried his eyes and took a last look around. It was almost night.
"I think I'm ready to go back now."
They found Alice where they'd left her, but she wasn't alone now. The others had come through while he was off on the far side. Elliot, Janet, Josh, Poppy, and they were standing around talking animatedly about plans to rebuild Castle Whitespire. Penny had stayed at his post in the Netherlands, but Plum was there. She was off by herself, just looking around and trying to take it all in. She was seeing Fillory for the first time in her life. Quentin caught her eye, and she smiled, but he thought she probably wanted to be alone with it for a few minutes. He remembered the first time he saw Fillory. He'd cried his eyes out in front of a clock tree. Not much chance of Plum doing that, but still, he'd give her some time. "No more spinning," Janet said. "That's all I ask. The spinning thing was always bullshit. I don't know how the dwarfs sold them on that in the first place." "I hear you," Elliot said. "I'm not..."